I've been to a bunch of committees, but not this one.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Interim Committee on Rules and Executive Appointments to order. We have a new member on our committee, our new vice chair, Senator Winters from Salem. And the rest of us are old hands from last session. So without further ado, we will open up an informational meeting on the overview of this Oregon small donor election system.
I'll go longer out there.
Okay, Adam.
Who else wants to come up? Please come on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have a current informational meeting providing an overview of the Oregon small donor elections. Senator Roblin will kick us off.
Okay.
And it looks like he is joined by Courtney Graham of the Bus Project.
That's really small.
Welcome, Senator Roblin.
That's medium.
I'm not used to seeing you from this angle.
I know. It's so exciting to be down here. So, for the record, Senator Arnie Roblin, House District 5. And I want to give a little bit of history. I will turn in a written comments, and this is and go back for us, but I won't read it. It's always nice to have fanfare before you get started.
I have no idea why I did that.
I do appreciate Senator Byers' extra noise for us. Since I got into running for office, it became clear to me that Oregon has a slightly different funding source for our elections. We have a pretty wide open...
Congratulations.
Twice now, Lee.
This would be a good reminder to the audience you don't want to subject yourself to this kind of embarrassment.
Fairly clear, and I've been involved in a number of different groups with Secretary of State in the past and others to have a conversation about what we should do about our funding system for campaigns. And it's been pretty clear, the Supreme Court's been pretty clear, that it's a free speech right to give money for campaigns. And so it is pretty wide open. And for those of you who don't know, District 5 is one of those districts that is pretty evenly divided, and so it becomes fairly expensive. Some of the elections in our state, you know, $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 will probably help get you elected because the disparity is so great. But in my district, from the very first time I ran, I got introduced to the idea that you were going to have to raise a lot of money. And from the early House races of $250,000 to $300,000 to the Senate races that get close to $1 million a time, it is a lot of money, and it means a lot of time is spent talking to a lot of people, and you get tired, and therefore you kind of think that it's really nice to have large donors give you large monies. And that's another part of the system in Oregon, and is that anybody can give any amount they want to give. And so you can get some large donors and give a lot of money, and it can make doing that pretty easy. The issue is, from my perspective, you really need to get to know your constituents. The best job you can do in the legislature is to know where your constituents are coming from. And as Senator Burdick has told me many times, the knocking on doors and talking to people is a really, really good way to get to know those people and get to find out what are the issues that are burning in their neighborhoods. And truthfully, it's a good way of getting elected if that's your bottom line goal. So this is an option that will allow people in the state to get involved in funding those elections and not having to go after those big donors by making everybody you talk to and every small donor that you can convince to give you $250 or less, that you're going to get that matched. And so every one of those $250 can be $500. And all of a sudden, if you start getting 500, 600, 1,000 people to give you those small donor amounts, you can actually end up with enough money to run campaigns in places like District 5 on the Oregon coast. And it is my opinion, you'll get to know your constituents better. You'll have a feeling that who you owe your allegiance to entirely is those people in those constituents in your district. And I think there's a reason for having this conversation. And as things go about changing at the federal level with respect to how funding is done, we've had some conversations at the Supreme Court about who should be able to fund and where the money can come. It gives new alternative ways for people who are engaged in the election process to get their message out, get the money necessary to run those campaigns, because when you have large geographic places like the coast, so, you know, 200 miles, 186 miles from one end to the other of my district, the more you travel, the more you get to know people, and the more you have, you need to have resources to get radio, TV, and all those kinds of things that get that message out. I think this is one option that should be available to Oregonians, and I look forward to hearing more. You'll be hearing from a senator, and we'll talk a little bit about that a little more by phone, I think, today. So with that, thank you for listening. I'll turn in written documents that has a little more information that you can read at your leisure. But I want to truly appreciate, Senator Burdick, your willingness to have this hearing in these legislative days, because I just think it's nice to get that information out and to have people understand what we're trying to do with this legislation.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. Thank you for your work on this. We don't have a bill in front of us. This
right.
is an informational hearing. But can you just go over the outlines of what? Should we let her do?
Okay. Yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Do you want to do the main representative first, or do you want to go first?
It's really at the discretion of the chair, but I'm happy to go now if that's easier.
Okay. Go ahead.
So we can get them on the phone. Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Winters, for the record, my name is Courtney Graham, and I'm currently serving as the Executive Director of the Oregon Bus Project, and I'm really glad to be here today to talk to you about our support for the creation of a small donor elections program here in Oregon. And part of the reason I'm here is our organization believes that our current system is a little out of balance. As Senator Roblin talked about, the influx of big money in elections and the rapidly rising cost of money that it takes to win campaigns means candidates need to raise large sums of money and rely on a relatively small number of wealthier donors who can give more than the average Oregonian in order to win their campaign. As a result, unfortunately, many voters no longer believe that their elected officials are working for them, and I think we can all agree that we would like to change that. So from a values-based perspective, the Small Donor Elections Program will take straightforward steps to help address that lack of public trust in our elections in a few key ways. First of all, it creates a voluntary program. So as Senator Roblin said, candidates can choose to participate in the program. And these are candidates who want to spend their time talking with their constituents and raising money from predominantly small individual donors, Oregonians who can give $250 or less, by matching those funds at a rate of 6-1. And by limiting the matching funds to only individual contributions, the program supports candidates who do spend their time talking with voters and constituents, not just wealthier donors and institutional supporters. Second, the program will really expand the pool of potential candidates who are going to be running in the state of Oregon to include those who are otherwise qualified but aren't able to afford the expensive cost of running a campaign or lack connections to wealthier donors. And third, by encouraging candidates to prioritize time spent with constituents, like I think all of us would like to do, and everyday people, all Oregonians will be given a bigger say in our government, thus impacting really the kinds of policies that are discussed and deliberated in this very building. And more specifically, to how the program would work, as I said, it's a voluntary program, so candidates will qualify for the program by proving that they have community support. To do so, candidates for the Senate will need to raise at least $10,000 from 400 qualifying small donors, and candidates for the House would have to raise $6,000 from 250 qualifying small donors within 120 days of filing intent to participate in the program. They're limited to a maximum of $6,000 in funds from any source to seed their campaign as an acknowledgement that you do need to get started. You have to start somewhere when you're campaigning. But will, after that, voluntarily agree to limit contributions that they accept to $250 per individual or organization. Only contributions from individuals residing in Oregon will be matched, and all other contributions from organizations, businesses, or PACs will not be matched, but can be accepted to the extent allowed by Oregon law in the terms of the program, so long as they're $250 or less. The maximum any candidate could receive in total matching funds is calculated based on the more expensive races from the last election cycle. So in 2020, that's a $1 million cap for the Senate and a $700,000 cap for the House. And that sounds like a lot. I'll talk about some of the other caps on the program. And some of those caps include that only half of eligible contributions, or up to $125, could be matched for candidates running in a primary race. We want to have a little bit of a viability test to make sure that folks who are running in the primary make it through that primary to the general election before we give them the rest of the matching amount. We also want to make sure that any candidate running opposed in a general election or in a primary race is limited to 5% of the total matching funds available for their race. We want to be good stewards of public dollars by making sure that we're limiting it in that way. And beyond those thresholds, there are other safeguards in place in the program that we're advocating for to ensure accountability with the program. So all candidates are required to return unused funds at the end of the campaign. We don't want anybody holding on to those matched dollars. Or in the event that they no longer qualify with the rules of the program. And candidates cannot spend public funds during the course of their campaign on anything other than legitimate campaign expenses and are subject to some additional requirements, such as a prohibition on paying family members or paying for services at a rate above fair market value. So you can't be paying those consultants any more than they would charge anyone else. And, you know, I'm happy to take any questions that folks have about specifics of the program, and I'll do my best to answer. But I would just like to say in closing that with a small donor program, we truly believe that candidates will be able to spend the majority of their time talking with their constituents, which means ordinary people like working families, young people, the constituency that we represent, low-income folks, and others historically left out of the process. And by empowering more people to be engaged in our elections in this way, we'll ultimately strengthen participation in our democracy, which is something that we're really supportive of and is a big motivating factor for us to support this. So thank you for taking the time. And as Senator Roblin said, thank you for prioritizing this conversation during legislative days.
Well, thank you for bringing this. There's a couple of issues. I actually have a different perspective. I'm actually the only person on this. Oh, you might have been affected, Senator Beyer. We had one cycle where we actually had campaign finance limitations.
Yep.
96. You ran in 96?
I ran in 96.
Yes. So
and then after it was lifted, then I was able to run and win.
Well, I came from a district where the race was in the primary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were limited to $30,000 a cap. It was very tight limits.
Yep.
We could take no more than $100 from an individual. Mm-hmm. Well, $100 for a couple.
Right.
That's right.
No, 200 for actually it was 200 for a couple. And so it was very hard to raise money. I had to return many checks from well-meaning people. No, I can't take this money. And but I really, you know, for my first race, I really appreciated it because I could send out fundraising letters that said, for $100, you can be my largest contributor. And I spent, I spent hours and hours and hours on the doorstep. That was my district,
yeah.
And I did win that primary. It was a very highly contested primary. But then in the general election in other districts, including districts like Senator Winters and probably Senator Byers' district to a degree, the independent organizations became involved in the campaign, and the candidate had so much less money than the independent groups that the candidates lost control of their campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, you know, given our laws, it's so hard to get anything that'll stand up constitutionally to limit people's participation like that. But it is a very, very deep concern of mine that candidates can lose control of their campaigns. So it's something to think about as we move forward. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Roblin.
We want to hear from the senator.
Yes, we do.
So much money.
Hello, Senator Mills.
It was you.
Yes, hi.
Hello. I was wondering if you might, this is Adam Crawford. I am the legislative policy and research analyst. I was wondering if it might be possible to mute the stream you are currently watching.
Hello?
I heard my own voice. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Senator Mills. I'm Jenny Burdick. I'm the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, and with me is Senator Winters, who's the vice chair, and Senator Boquist and Senator Beyer. And of course, Senator Roblin, who's also a member of this committee, is one of our witnesses on this. So we would love to hear from you for your testimony on this issue.
Well, thank you. I've been watching you on my screen. I think there's a delay in the screen because I was hearing you talk while, and then not on the phone you seemed to be earlier. I shut my screen off so it won't conflict. Chairman Burdick, I'm presently the executive director of the Maine Turnpike Authority in Maine, but had that position since 2011. But I ran, and I believe the first time was 2000. I was already in the state Senate, having been elected conventionally back in 1994. And Oregon adopted this clean election system in 1998, and I believe we adopted it, I think it was in 2000, and I ran at that juncture and again in 2002 and 04. I ran for the House in 04 because we have term limits in Maine, and I couldn't stay in the Senate, so I stepped down and ran in the House and won, and then came back to the Senate in 2006. And in that, but there was also a year in which I ran for governor in the Republican primary using the clean election system. And then I ran in the Senate again, and I lost that, and then ran in 08. And then in 10, I ran for governor again in the primary and lost to the present governor. So I've run at three different levels, the House, the Senate, and two gubernatorial primaries under the same, fundamentally the same system, which was a $5, you solicited $5 contributions from a very large number of people. If you were running for governor, it was like 3,500 of them, I think. And then that got you into a qualifying status and allowed you to draw down a fair amount of public funding. I think it was running for governor, I think it was on the order of $300,000, $350,000 for the primary, and then for the general election, it was probably, I didn't get that for it, but I think it was $700,000 or $800,000 on top. But we're a very different political climate here. We have 151 House members, and they only represent, each House member only represents about 8,700 people. And the Senate represents about 35,000, 37,000, really. And so our financial needs are more modest, perhaps, in terms of getting elected. You know, we're a very rural state. And but I can say qualitatively that the introduction of this system helped enormously with recruiting of candidates. And I say that as a Republican because it both Republicans and Democrats, I think, had the same reaction. I had a lot to do with trying to recruit people to run for office, and something that all of us as veterans needed to do for the sake of the party. And it was just a whole lot easier to get quality people, qualified and high quality candidates to commit to running if they didn't have to go through the burden of raising most of their own money. And it wasn't so much that they weren't able. Many of them, you know, have the capacity to reach out and raise money, but it's just something they say, I choose not to do that. I would prefer not to spend my life with a major part of it over a span of 6 months or a year, simply being on the phone trying to raise hundreds of dollars from everybody that I talk to. And it's just, that's one of the reasons I think many people today really don't want to run for Congress, because Congress is famous for this right now. You have to spend half of your time practically on the phone, whether you're in Washington or at home. So that was a major, I would say that was the primary advantage that the system brought to us. It just was a breath of fresh air to the whole procedure of reaching out every other year to try to find decent people to run. It was perhaps more extreme here because we have term limits, and so we do have turnover, and our recruiting process is more intense, perhaps, than it is in other states. But it was really refreshing to have the system in place, and it's still, even in the beginning, we had the capacity to draw down matching funds if you had an opponent who had independent expenditures or any expenditures that were larger than those afforded by the public financing. That was ruled unconstitutional several years ago, and participation in the process did drop off slightly as a result of that change. But in 2016, we found that about four-fifths of the Democrats ran under the clean election system, and half of the Republicans ran under the clean election system. About 64% of the present members of the legislature in Maine were elected having used it currently. A few years ago, those figures were as high as 80 or 85% in some cycles. But it remains a very popular program. It was adopted by referendum in the initial go-around, and it was reaffirmed. There were substantial modifications to the system just recently, and those were, again, reaffirmed by public referendum. So, and I think, I don't know too much about what's going on in Arizona now, but I suspect that there's still some interest there. It does allow you to reach a certain point in your, when you make the commitment to run for office, at the very beginning, you recognize that you're going to have to get out and raise a certain number of small contributions from people. And that you do. But when you reach a certain point where you become eligible for public financing, you breathe a sigh of relief and say, oh, great, now I can spend all of my time campaigning. I don't have to do fundraising anymore. It is a wonderfully refreshing threshold to reach in the process of running for the state office. I like the Oregon, what I've heard about the Oregon draft, I like it better than our system. I like the idea of having small donations leading to a match, like a 6-to-1 match. I think that's a more understandable system. It's a simpler system. It's a little easier, I think, to navigate than the one that we have, where they have these $5, I won't go into the details, but the $5 check system is, there's a lot of nitty-gritty to it that's hard to follow. And I think the system that you're proposing makes more sense, frankly. Hmm. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you folks have.
Okay. What do you do, if anything, about independent expenditures in Maine?
Those are a serious problem. And the matching fund component was a very good remedy for that. And I had it happen to me once. I had a very strong opponent that took me on from the other party, and her party came to her rescue and gave her a lot of money, very much toward the end of the campaign. And it was an independent expenditure. She was running under the clean election system, and all of a sudden there was this money floating into these ads coming out that were independently funded. But I drew down, at that juncture, I drew down more public funding to match it. I won anyway, I'm not sure that the extra money that I got was necessarily a big factor, but it may have been my point. But that's gone now. And so there are independent expenditures being made. And indeed, a great deal of the attempt, this is the interesting thing. The money that creates those funds comes, how do I say this? If there's a particular interest group that wants to, say, support me for office, They can't do it directly. They have to give it to either the Republican Party or to the PAC, a PAC that's run by the Senate, if I'm in the Senate. And then it's the PAC that spends that money on whichever race they choose to spend it on. Typically, they look around to see what races are close, and then the independent money flows into those races independently, but flows in where either party feels that they've got a horse race going on where they can possibly win with the injection of more money. But the interesting thing is that the candidate himself or herself isn't beholden to the source of those funds, if it's coming, particularly if it's coming through the party. I mean, it's just, it isn't a direct gift to the candidate. It isn't a solicited gift, a solicited donation. So there is a little bit of, there's a pretty decent level, really, of insulation between the candidate and the sources of this money. And it doesn't flow, it is not a particular factor in those cases that are not, in those races that are not close. It's only in the close races that the independent expenditures come into play, and they are, as I said, somewhat isolated from the beneficiary of them is somewhat isolated from their, from the source.
Okay, thank you.
But I don't know any way of getting around the independent expenditure issues either in any system that we have today. It's just the law of the land. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee for any of the panel members?
Not a question, but a comment, because when we lifted the cap on contributions in Oregon, it actually, the independent expenditure piece, which actually had a bigger role of playing when we had the cap on there, and they actually controlled more of the campaigns than they do today.
Right.
Sure.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for participating in our discussion today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Oh, good luck with it.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Okay. Our next witnesses will be a panel, Jenny Lee, Steve Carter, and Susan Mottet.
Mottet, you'll tell us.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Winters, and members of the committee. My name is Jenny Lee. I am the Advocacy Director at the Coalition of Communities of Color. We are a coalition of 19 culturally specific organizations dedicated to cross-cultural collective action for racial equity. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here in support today of small donor elections. This session, we have a major opportunity to make Oregon's democracy more representative of Oregon's people, including communities of color, by implementing small donor elections. The Coalition of Communities of Color believes that this kind of program is a critical step toward ensuring that every voice is heard in our democracy. Today, too many candidates have been passed over because of the money needed to run competitively, and too many community members have not been heard because they lack the resources to make major contributions. It's communities of color, immigrants, and refugees who are some of those most impacted by the structural barriers to building the wealth needed to make these contributions. As a result, they are most impacted by the barriers needed also to run for office. Small donor elections will amplify the voices of community members who are not wealthy and empower candidates without access to a network of wealthy donors, but who do have the support of their community. Oregon's elected officials do not yet represent our state's population, but we can inspire more diverse candidates to run for office by breaking down the barriers money creates in elections. When candidates are relieved from the pressure of pursuing large contributions, as we've heard, they can focus on connecting with all voters, including those who have been historically underrepresented and marginalized. Community members can also become more engaged as they see their power to influence candidates grow through their small donations. We have an important example of how small donor elections actually work to increase and diversify participation by comparing New York State and New York City's election systems. New York City has a small donation elections program. New York State does not. In New York State elections, only 30% of neighborhoods within New York City make small donor contributions. These neighborhoods are wealthier and less racially diverse than the city as a whole. When comparing that to city elections, this goes up to 90% of communities making small donor contributions. And these are the communities that tend to be more reflective of the diversity of income and ethnicity in the city. Candidates of color and the voices of communities of color have important policy solutions that will be to offer that will build a stronger Oregon for all of us. On behalf of the Coalition of Communities of Color, I urge you to take action to amplify the voices of every Oregonian and advance equity by implementing a small donor elections program. Thank you.
I can't pass up a comment.
Certainly.
I absolutely cannot pass one who was elected in 98, and I represent, and I live in Salem. From an ethnic standpoint, from an African-American standpoint, I have less than 0.2%. And if I look at Oregon, and at one time you had not only myself, you had Senator Gordley, Senator Carter, and you had Representative Bowman, and our population the membership in this body was greater than the population per ratio in Oregon. So I need to say that I don't want to compare with New York City, and I did live in New York at one time, because it's not necessarily that the demographics reflect that's who you're going to actually send to here to serve in this body. And I'd like to get away from that, because I would like to hope to think that individuals are elected here to come here to represent them because of skill and other factors. And I need to put that on the record, because too many people listen to what we have to say. Here. So just to say that for Oregon, I can't speak for New York, but I can certainly speak for this great state.
Thank you, Vice Chair.
Let's continue with the panel, and then we'll open up for questions. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Carter, and thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee for the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon. I am a volunteer with AARP Oregon, and I'm here to urge your support for the concept of small donor elections taking it statewide in the legislature. I've been a longtime reporter and editor at the Oregonian. I've now been retired for some time, but I have been frustrated for a long time at the cost of running for office in Oregon. The process, because it's so expensive, the races have become so expensive, it shuts many people out of the process. And I think small donor elections are one way to open up the door for more viable candidates to run for office. One of the tenets of AARP nationally is civic engagement. We believe very strongly that civic engagement is extremely important in a democracy. And small donor elections, in our view, is one way to increase civic engagement, because it gives people the opportunity for their small donations to make a difference. That's important. It's important that to allow people to have the feeling that it's not all about big money in Oregon or anywhere else for that matter. If you can have your donation matched on a 6-to-1 basis, like this legislation suggests, then you start to believe that, hey, I can get involved, I can make a difference. And we know from New York City, as this witness has explained, that it increases the participation from a broader geographic perspective of people getting involved in the political process. It also allows candidates, as Senator Roblin has suggested, to talk to more ordinary folks in their districts. And so they don't have to spend all their time on the phone talking to people who can give large donations, big checks. They can talk to people whose concerns may be somewhat varied from those who are, have some special interest. So I think from a standpoint of the AARP, we really support this idea. We think it will lead to some more diversity in candidates for running for office. And we are happy to be part of this very broad coalition of grassroots organizations, civic groups that are sponsoring this idea. We have something like 500,000 members statewide, and we wholeheartedly endorse the idea of small donor elections. And I thank you very much for your opportunity to talk to you, and thanks to Representative Dan Rayfield for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Susan Matei, the State Legislative Director at Every Voice, a national organization dedicated to designing, passing, and supporting successful implementation of small donor election reform. I'm going to briefly summarize my written testimony. First, I wanted to just clarify some constitutional issues. The other witness from Maine, Peter Mills, had mentioned that the Supreme Court had imposed a limit on programs like this. They can't contain a particular type of trigger provision in which some privately spent money for an opponent would trigger public funds to a participating candidate. Their other limitation is the program must be voluntary. And I just wanted to note that the small donor elections bill that is being drafted here is both voluntary and contains no trigger provision of any kind, and that otherwise the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled these programs constitutional, saying that they do not abridge, restrict, or censor speech, but rather use public money to facilitate and enlarge public discussion and participation in the electoral process, goals vital to a self-governing people. They further not abridge pertinent First Amendment values. The next thing I wanted to provide some information about was what voters think about the issue of money in politics. Voters are not just concerned about money in politics. They're feeling increasing urgency about passing reform. In 2016, for the first time in, I think, a couple of decades at least, the problem of money in politics eclipsed the economy as the number one issue in voters' minds. In fact, a 2016 multi-state poll, money in politics represented three of the four top voter concerns. One, there's too much money in politics. Two, incomes aren't keeping pace with the cost of living. Three, big corporations and lobbyists have too much control over our government and elections. And four, too many regular people's voices aren't being heard by elected leaders. Even here in Oregon, we had done a poll in November of 2015, so it didn't capture the increase in concern that we've been seeing nationally that occurred in 2016 and 2017. But even in 2015 in Oregon, 69% of Oregon voters want legislators to meaningfully take up this issue, specifically favoring new laws to control how campaigns raise and spend money in state elections. Only 17% opposed, leaving a 52-point margin in favor of new rules on this. I wanted to note that these are not new programs. We heard from someone from Maine, but there are actually 32 states and localities that have a small donor elections program of some type. And as a result, we are able to study these programs and see how they work and measure their outcomes and whether they're successful and design programs that will be successful. But they're not cookie cutter. You can't take the exact same program from one place and drop it into another because your campaign finance climate is different. So Every Voice looked at over 100,000, every campaign contribution in four cycles of elections in Oregon to see data like what does it cost to win elections and how big are your donor bases, et cetera, to help design, take the what we've learned from other programs and create a successful type of program that will work in Oregon specifically. And finally, we did hear from Peter Mills about his experience with a similar program in Maine. And I just wanted to note that in my uploaded testimony, I have some more quotes from other legislators who have worked within similar programs in their states. And I just wanted to highlight two quotes. One is from former state representative Al Adinolfi from Connecticut, who is a Republican in a pretty strongly blue-leaning state, who said that now, after the program was implemented, now people concentrate more on the issues, read the issues. You see more votes that are bipartisan, and the big issues get bipartisan votes. And State Representative Jason Rojas, also from Connecticut, said, I like being able to get my fundraising from the people I'm not going to owe anything to except the responsibility of doing a good job. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel?
I do, because you looked at the small donor. Did you actually also look at the cost of campaigning? And I, you know, the gentleman talked about, he was with the Oregonian, because the expense of running campaigning is what drives so much of the raising of dollars in order to get one's message. And it's only until recently that we're talking about social media and some of those other avenues. But depending upon where you are in Oregon, if I'm in the metropolitan area and you're having to do TV and some of those other markets in order to contact, and I don't know of any legislator here in this body who doesn't do door-to-door, knock on doors, and meet with their constituency group. So when you did your analysis, did you also factor in the cost of what campaigns actually cost?
Oh, that's one of the most important things we factor in. You can't design a successful program without looking at that. And we particularly look at what does it cost to win the most expensive campaigns, because that's where you might see a candidate who's deciding whether or not to use the program say, well, can this program actually help me raise enough money to compete? And so we made sure that it was just generous enough to make sure a candidate can compete without being too generous and being, you know, so that we could be good stewards of state funds.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. It's been very educational. Okay, we will close the informational meeting on Oregon small donor elections and open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee legislative concepts. And just for the audience and for the committee, just a reminder that introduction of bills does not imply support or opposition. It's to get concepts into the process. Senator Winters and I have discussed these and two of these bills, LC 166 and LC 172, will be introduced at the request of the chair, and LC 133 will be introduced jointly with Senator Winters, the vice chair, and myself. So, Adam, maybe you could just go over what these concepts do.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are three legislative concepts before us today. LC 133, dated January 2nd, 2018. LC 133 is primarily a technical fix bill relating to elections issues. My understanding is this was brought forward by both the county clerks in conjunction with the Secretary of State to discuss primarily technical and small bore issues prior to the 2018 election. We also have LC 166, dated December 18, 2017. This requires a major political party candidate for president or vice president to file either their most recently updated federal income tax return or a statement of economic interest to appear on a ballot and within the Oregon voters pamphlet. LC 172, dated December 21st, 2017, enacts the Interstate Compact for an agreement among the states to elect the president by a national popular vote. It then refers that measure to the people of Oregon for approval or rejection at the next general election.
Okay. Questions for Adam? Okay. Senator Winters.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the following LC be introduced as committee bills, LC 133, LC 166, and LC 172.
Senator Winters has moved LC 133, LC 166, and LC 172 be introduced as committee bills. Is there discussion?
Senator Boquist.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on yours from the loyal opposition across the side, to reiterate, as you pointed out, that, you know, the introduction of legislative concepts, as you mentioned, does not indicate support or opposition. And being across the aisle, we look forward to the various discussions and debates.
Thank you very much for putting that on the record. Other discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. So, committee, that completes our business in under an hour. This, don't get used to it. So right now, we are adjourned.